Grey Malkin Media presents Werewolf, A True Story of Demonic Possession by Ed and Lorraine Warren and William Ramsey with Robert David Chase. Read for you by Todd Habercorn. These are the true accounts of the paranormal investigators featured in the Conjuring films. Since the 1960s, Ed and Lorraine Warren have been the world's most renowned paranormal investigators. Lorraine is a gifted clairvoyant, while Ed is the only non-ordained demonologist recognized by the Catholic Church. Together, they have investigated thousands of hauntings in their career.
Introduction. At least as far back as ancient Greece, there have been people who believed they had the power to change from human beings into animals. A few centuries later, gypsy culture fostered the belief that such individuals were cursed and became killers as a result. Gypsy culture paid special attention to the transformation of man into wolf. This phenomenon became known as lycanthropy, and, while most people doubted that such a transformation could actually take place, the journals of several medieval doctors attest to the fact that such changes did overtake some of their patients. In 1798, in France, a particularly sordid and violent case took place. Jean-Paul Grenier was a teenage boy who had few friends. As a consequence, he spent a great deal of time in the forest with animals. He felt that he had devised a language that enabled him to speak directly to his new friends, a complicated series of grunts and groans accompanied by sign language. The older he grew, the more alienated he became from human culture. He had a father, a poor laborer, but the man spent little time with his son. Never an especially intelligent boy, Jean-Paul was hardly a scholar and, given his few social skills, hardly the sort of raconteur French society seems to value. Ultimately, he spent most of his time in the forest with his animal friends, particularly the wolves. Jean-Paul felt a special relationship with wolves. Like him, they were solitary and isolated animals, and they were picked on. Hunters loved to bring back wolf pelts. It was said that Jean-Paul befriended the wolves so intimately that they led him to the caves where they slept and showed him how to hunt and store food. At some point in all this, Jean-Paul began to imagine himself a wolf. He seems to have given up being a human being entirely. Those who knew him said that he began to walk with a peculiar slanting gait and that sometimes, in the darkness, they heard him howling in a very bone-chilling way. We would know nothing of Jean-Paul Grenier today if all he'd done was to emulate his friends, the wolves. Hundreds of kooks and oddballs are born every day. But Jean-Paul did something else. He went on to become one of the most heinous and savage murderers in the history of the world. Jean-Paul went on a reign of terror that saw him stealing babies from their prams, rending and eating them, and then carrying off any excess meat to the forest, where he shared it with the wolves. Fortunately, Jean-Paul was soon apprehended and confessed to many of his alleged crimes. However, he insisted that his father had helped him. As evidence of this, he stated, one only had to ask his stepmother, who had supposedly left the man because she'd seen him vomit up the paws of a dog and the fingers of a child. The court that tried Jean-Paul's case let the father go free, but Jean-Paul was sentenced to a monastery where, it was said, his features became even more wolf-like, and he lost all interest in human activities. He died, confined to a small cell at age 20. Jean-Paul may be gone, but our fascination with man into wolf continues today. What you are about to read is a carefully documented modern-day account of the terrible curse of lycanthropy. Lycanthropy is not something that most of us choose to talk about. While it is clearly still with us today and would explain the behavior of many serial killers, as one man from Scotland Yard recently noted, we choose to dismiss it nervously with smirks and disdain. But as you read this book, you will see how real and how terrible lycanthropy is, and how relentlessly it destroys the lives of decent men and those who love them. You would be especially taken with William David Ramsay's plight, if you could meet him, and see how mild-mannered, thoughtful, and kind he is when the curse is not upon him. Here, then, is the story of William David Ramsay, Werewolf. Ed and Lorraine Warren. frightened nurse. On the night of December 5th, 1983, in the English working-class town of Southend-on-Sea, Essex, an emergency room nurse was about to step outside the door and have her third cigarette for the day. This was the somewhat desperate agreement she'd made with herself. As a nurse, she knew how destructive cigarettes were. Yet, as a 29-year-old human being with a very high-stress job, she found herself thoroughly addicted. So, over the past 3 months, she'd made a deal with herself. 3 cigarettes a day, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, one in the evening, gradually weaning herself to the point where she smoked no cigarettes at all, or so she'd hoped. Now, just before 10 p.m., she was about to indulge herself in the last smoke of the day. Because the hospital had strict no-smoking rules, she always had to step outside. She hurried along the corridor toward the exit door, thankful that she'd finally gotten some time for herself this evening. Tonight, the emergency room had been a human zoo, with 3 bad car wrecks, a very violent domestic disturbance which left a poor housewife badly beaten, and 1 small boy who was running a fever so high there was probably going to be some permanent brain damage. He had been running the fever for the past 2 days, but his mother had just now gotten around to bringing him in. Sometimes the nurse wished she had the power to put certain parents in jail. The way they treated their children was positively criminal. Now, fortunately, things had calmed down some. Visiting hours being over, the hospital was settling in for the night. Lights had been dimmed. Nurses in efficient black shoes flitted from room to room with pills and injections. And patients, their surgeries over and eager to be home with their loved ones, resigned themselves to 1 more night in a hospital bed. A hush had descended over everything, even the emergency room, where the only patient waiting was now a scruffy, pathetic junkie who was suffering paranoid delusions that his last fix had poisoned him. One of the interns had done a stint in a mental hospital, and he was now being sought so he could deal with the junkie. And the nurse was just on her way out the door. The night was chill and rainy. Billowy fog rolled up from the sea and clung to all the hospital buildings. Visibility was practically zero. The sounds of the city, still somewhat raucous at this hour, were curiously muffled and distant. The nurse lit her cigarette. As usual, it tasted much better than she wanted it to, and after a while she heard the footsteps. At first, she wasn't sure what the sound was. A rough scratching of some sort was her first estimate, but then she realized that the sounds were coming from the fog-shrouded walk in front of her. After a moment longer, she realized that she was hearing footsteps of some kind. She had been standing here enjoying both the cigarette and the bracing damp air when the footsteps began to upset her. The nurse was one of those women who could never watch horror movies. They scared her too much, and the footsteps reminded her of something in a horror movie. Here she was, a thoroughly modern and quite intelligent young woman, standing in front of the entrance to a major hospital filled with dozens and dozens of people, and she was afraid. Maybe if she could have seen who the footsteps belonged to, she would have been all right. But they were disembodied sounds, lost in the depths of the fog, but coming closer. Closer. She shuddered. She looked behind her, through the glass door. The hospital corridor was long and empty. The footsteps were louder now, and there was a peculiar scraping sound, as if something were being dragged across the cement walk. She glanced over her shoulder again at the empty corridor. A year or so ago, a nurse had been raped in the nearby parking lot, and nobody had heard her screams until it was much too late. The nurse wondered if anybody would hear her screams if she needed help. A form began to emerge from the fog. At first, she assumed it was a man, but then the way it hunched over and the curious, claw-like way it carried its hands made her wonder. The figure stopped, no more than a silhouette in the night fog that covered it. The figure was no more than 10 feet from the nurse. She could hear how hard her heart was hammering. She could feel cold sweat cover her armpits and the soles of her feet.
"Hello,"
she said, but there was no reply.
"Hello."
She squinted, hoping to get a better sense of the creature that stood before her. The creature took 1 step forward. The nurse bolted. All her training, all her intelligence said that she should have stayed there, but she didn't. Couldn't. She was too frightened. She jerked open the door and ran into the corridor. She didn't look back until she was halfway down the empty hall and about to turn right toward the emergency ward. There she ran straight into another nurse named Carol Peeler.
"Are you all right?"
Peeler asked, seeing how shaken her friend looked.
"Fine,"
the nurse managed to squeeze out. She'd thought of telling Peeler about the odd-sounding footsteps and the curious shape in the fog, but she decided her reputation would suffer if she revealed how frightened she'd been out there. Nurses pride themselves on their practical nature, and a practical nature excluded seeing boogeymen in the fog.
"You sure you're fine?"
Peeler asked.
"Positive,"
the nurse said, forcing a chuckle.
"I'd better be getting back."
She walked away quickly, glad to be free of Peeler's scrutiny. She stopped in the bathroom, where she splashed water on her face, tried to rinse the smell of smoke out of her mouth, and patted her red hair back into place with long, skilled fingers. When she got back to the emergency room, she found that the paranoid junkie had been joined by a big man who'd just had his nose splattered across his face, presumably in a tavern brawl of some kind. Except for the creature she'd glimpsed in the fog, this was a very typical weekend night for the nurse in the emergency room. She immediately set about working, trying to forget all about the strange shape and sounds in the fog and shadow. The Long Night. 2 hours later, the emergency room had filled up again, largely due to an accident involving a van that had overturned in a ditch. This was one of those accidents that convinced even the most cynical that there was some kind of divine providence operating in the vast universe. In the course of the accident, during which the van had overturned twice, the vehicle's roof had been smashed all the way down to the top of the seats. Incredibly, while at least one or two of the passengers should have been killed, nobody suffered an injury worse than a sprained wrist, though clearly the passengers were badly shaken and all still quite drunk. The nurse worked with two of the passengers, applying bandages to a few nicks and scrapes, and supplying them with steaming cups of black coffee. Two stern policemen waited in the lobby to talk to the driver, who was obviously going to be charged with operating a vehicle while under the influence of alcohol. Hearing a noise at the far end of the emergency room, the nurse walked crisply to the door to see what was going on. She opened the door and looked in on a man whose appearance and demeanor shocked and frightened her immediately. She knew that this was the creature she'd seen in the fog. In the light of the emergency ward, he looked quite human. But he also looked seriously disturbed.
"Won't you help me?"
he said.
"Of course,"
she replied, more coldly than she'd intended.
"That's what we're here for."
"I have to tell you what's happening to me."
"Why don't you come in and sit down and tell me?"
The man shook his head violently.
"No. Before I go in there, I want to tell you the truth."
"Oh,"
the nurse said.
"The truth, is it?"
By now she was convinced that this man was just as drunk as the van passengers. Drunks often suffered delusions of various sorts, and this man was clearly suffering from one now.
"Something's happening to me. I'm turning into a wolf."
The nurse's first reaction was to laugh, but then suddenly she realized what had been puzzling her about the way the man carried himself. Though superficially he looked normal enough, 5'7" or thereabouts, and probably 180 pounds, he was bent over at the shoulders and his hands curled up as if they were claws. And then, as she stood there listening in disbelief, a deep, rumbling growl traveled up the man's chest, into his throat, and out of his mouth. The unmistakable rumbling growl of a wolf. His lips pulled back over his teeth now. His eyes were crazed. Before she knew what was happening, the man lashed out with one of his clawed hands. He struck her with a force so violent she was slammed into the wall, the back of her head smashing into the plaster so hard that the nurse slipped into unconsciousness. Unfortunately for the nurse, the policeman had gone down the hall to interview the van driver, leaving only two patients in the emergency room lobby. They proved to be chivalrous sorts, jumping from their seats and coming immediately to the nurse's rescue. They tried to, anyway. The wolfman was not easy to subdue. No matter how often they struck him, even kicking him a few times, he did not fall to the floor. Instead, he swiped at them with his powerful, claw-like hands. He got one of the men squarely on the jaw, The man dropped immediately to the floor.
An orderly, just coming around the corner, saw the strange battle in process and heard the eerie, blood-chilling howl coming from the burly, muscular man, who somehow resembled a human wolf.
The orderly ran down the hall and told a doctor what was going on. The doctor, who often had to subdue drunks in the emergency ward, got his trusty hypodermic, put 3 cc's of Thorazine in it, and proceeded to follow the orderly down the hall. By now the man had knocked both patients unconscious and was beginning to hurl pieces of furniture around the lobby. The orderly gulped, knowing he would have to distract the man, so the doctor could sneak up and stab the man with the needle. This was like being asked to serve yourself up as finger food to a lion who hadn't eaten in a couple of months. The orderly ducked in front of the wolf man, shouted for him to calm down, and waited for the inevitable reaction. The wolf man grabbed the orderly, lifted him up several inches off the floor, and then hurled him back into the wall. The orderly was just trying to duck a punch the wolf man had thrown when the doctor finally jabbed the needle into the wolf man's right buttock and injected the fluid instantly. The sting of the shot so enraged the wolf man that he forgot all about the orderly and swung around to confront the doctor. The doctor had never seen anything like this. The transformation from man to wolf was chillingly complete. Everything about the man suggested a perfect fusion of the two species. And then, thankfully, the Thorazine overtook the wolf man, and he began slowly to sink to the floor. He continued to growl. He continued to strike out. But the force was gone from him now. Finally, he collapsed in a heap. The orderly helped the nurse to her feet, and together they went to join the doctor in staring down at the curious creature at their feet.
"I've never seen anything like this," the doctor said. "What the hell is going on here?"
Soon the rest of the world would be joining the doctor and asking that same question about one Mr. Bill Ramsey,
a man whom the press would inevitably dub the Wolfman. Consider the werewolf. He is quite different from any other supernatural or preternatural being of legend and myth.
Any monster born in the imaginations of writers and filmmakers.
He is not a creature fashioned of human parts and brought to life in a madman's laboratory. He is not a member of the undead, a zombie resurrected by the magic of a voodoo priest, nor the mummy of an Egyptian king kept alive for centuries by sorcery and tana leaves, nor a vampire who must drink blood in order to maintain his unnatural life, who can change himself at will into a bat, who must sleep during the day because exposure to sunlight will cause him to shrink and perish. He does not have the evil powers of a witch, a warlock, or one of Satan's demons. He is not a thing that flies or crawls or scuttles, not a rodent or an insect mutated into monstrous and deadly size. He is just a man, a woman, a mortal human being who is cursed. Bill Pronzini, The Werewolf.
Ye Shall Know Them. William David Ramsey was born into a world gone mad. While people didn't take much note of Ramsey's birth on November 11, 1943, they certainly paid grim attention to a man named Adolf Hitler and his plan for world domination. Ramsey's earliest memories were of the war and its aftermath, especially the toll taken on London by Hitler's bombers. Ramsey was born and grew up in Southend-on-Sea, one of those pleasant seaside towns one sees in England. For several decades, the town had largely been supported by the dollars of tourists. Each summer, Southend-on-Sea became the type of town Graham Greene made famous in Brighton Rock, a combination of resort and carnival. Every few hours, dirty steam trains disgorged eager, noisy passengers from London and its suburbs. This was the kind of place people of modest means came to for quick vacations, wandering around the amusement arcades and the hot dog stands, and spending hours in pubs where patrons often joined together in song. During the day, the air was filled with the shouts of children and young lovers riding the plunging roller coaster, or strolling the carnival midway and gawking at the bearded lady, or sneaking a peek into one of the freak shows. One of the most popular attractions was the water chute. At night, the pace slowed some. Fireworks could be seen exploding against the soft night sky, and middle-aged people dined in numerous restaurants that served good food at reasonable prices.
Young and old alike strolled the beach, the foam of the breakers glowing white in the silver moonlight, the distant sound of a music hall trumpet solo lonely on the night air. Young Bill Ramsey. There was nothing remarkable about young Bill Ramsey. He liked sports, girls, movies, and walking through the town when it was gearing up for tourists. Bill always liked to imagine that he was a visitor here, too, with a nice bunch of change jangling in his pocket and the prospect of meeting one of the sweet, pretty girls who always were following around their prim, proper mothers. From a very early age, Bill worked at a variety of jobs. The British working-class tradition is simple enough. From the time you're able to lift a hammer, operate a shovel, or haul a can of garbage, you work. Bill worked, and it was a good thing, too, because he was a mostly indifferent student when he was at Hamstall Road Junior School, and later, when he attended South Church Hall High School for boys. He was, however, exceptionally good at English and French. He loved language, and he loved stories. He was by no means stupid. Several of his teachers noted that, indeed. Bill displayed great intellectual curiosity, but he could never seem to concentrate in any systematic way on his studies. There was always a soccer game, Bill was the goalie, or a girl to be courted, or a movie to be seen. Bill especially loved the movies. Saturday matinees were high holy ritual, sitting in that sacred darkness with dozens of other working-class children. In those days, most boys his age liked the American Westerns. For an English lad, the Wild West was virtually another world. Wide open spaces, whooping savage Indians, and iconic heroes such as John Wayne and Randolph Scott. The movies were Bill's great escape. He loved sitting with his popcorn and being carried off to other lands and times. No matter how badly things might be going in real life from time to time, the movies were always a friend. Eventually, the tourist business that Southend-on-Sea had enjoyed for so many decades all but vanished. The English people became generally better off, and foreign holidays had become more fashionable and affordable. Whatever the reasons, Southend-on-Sea could no longer rely on tourist dollars for its income. As a result, the small city went through a long and painful time before it found its niche again. Many Southenders began taking jobs in London, which was 40 miles down the turnpike. The nature of the town changed. Here and there, stores began closing down. The amusement park was quiet now, even on summer nights, and Southend-on-Sea was no longer a natural place for the locals to play. Now London was. Fortunately, two large government offices were eventually built in Southend-on-Sea, and a little later, a large credit card company also settled here. And so the economy returned to, at least, a semblance of its former self. In the early 1960s, a group of disenfranchised American intellectuals participated in a literary movement that came to be known as the Beat Generation. Poetry, marijuana, and free love were the hallmarks of this movement, at least as seen by the responsible American press. There was an equivalent movement in England, but there the young people were known as the Angry Young Men, and theirs, unlike that of their American counterparts, was primarily a working-class movement. Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, a poetic but bleak novel about a young Brit laborer, became the focal point for the Angry Young Men. As a result, it was a good time to be a working stiff in London and its environs. For the first time in British history, young working men actually had a romantic mystique about them. Bill Ramsey, then just turning 20, was well aware of the social change around him. After leaving high school in 1958, 2 years before graduation, Bill drifted through a series of menial jobs in the construction industry before discovering, to his great relief and profit, that he had real talent as a carpenter. His income improved, and so did his self-esteem. Unmarried, Bill sought out the good life, as lived in the London of that time. Bands such as the Beatles and the Rolling Stones were about to become huge sensations, and beautiful exotic birds, such as Twiggy, were about to revolutionize the fashion industry. It was quite a time for a healthy, happy young man with money in his pocket and fun on his mind, and Bill took advantage of it. Many nights he'd stumble into bed after midnight, but be up at cockcrow for work. In 1965, Bill married Abby, They had three children, Anne, Gail, and Ted, rather quickly. Bill's carousing days were over. He settled into the kind of life generations of working men had found fulfilling, if somewhat predictable. He learned to change diapers without sticking either the baby or himself. He learned how to spell his wife when the burden of three offspring simply proved too much and she desperately needed a break. And he learned how to love children, calling on reservoirs of patience and charity he didn't know he had. Sometime during all this, the dream began. Bill Ramsey had always felt a little shy and insecure around most people. As one of eight children in a relatively poor family, he'd never felt particularly loved. Indeed, he often felt quite lonely. Not even when an elder sister was adopted by another family did the Ramseys have much additional money. Bill covered his insecurities, of course, with seemingly easy smiles and a generally good-natured manner. But inside, Bill always wondered if he was the nice, normal man he appeared to be. He had so many insecurities, it was almost as if he were carrying around some terrible secret about himself. The dream was simple enough. His wife stood at the kitchen sink on a sunny spring morning, washing the breakfast dishes. He approached her from behind and called her name aloud. She turned around to face him. She was smiling. But the smile vanished instantly, and she began screaming, covering her eyes and shrieking so loudly that he was forced to flee the kitchen. He had become some kind of monster. That's why she screamed. There could be no other explanation for it. He had the dream many times in the mid-60s. He kept it to himself, afraid and ashamed. Always the question was the same. What had his wife seen in his face when she turned around? What could possibly be so hideous that she'd scream this way and force him to leave? During the summer of 1967, the dream stopped. No longer did Bill Ramsey wake up sweating and exhausted from thrashing about on the bed. No longer did Bill Ramsey wake up touching his face to see what was wrong with it. Now, life returned to normal. The children were getting older. The Ramseys had managed to set a little money aside, and Bill and Abby had never been more in love. Bill didn't think about the dream again until a year and a half later during a freezing snowstorm. He awoke in the darkness of his bed. Next to him, Abby lay sleeping peacefully. At first he was confused. He wondered what had awakened him. He even considered the possibility that he was dreaming. And then he heard the low animal rumbling there in the darkness. Some kind of beast crouched in the shadows of the room, ready to strike. My God, how was this possible? The rumbling came again. Bill froze, unable to move. He felt like a terrible coward. He should be up on his feet, defending his family. Instead, he was... There was rumbling again, but this time, Bill Ramsey realized where the sound was coming from. Himself. From his own chest. He thought now of his old nightmare, of watching his wife turn around and face him, and begin to scream. And then he thought of the animal rumbling noise in his chest and throat. Was that what had frightened Abby in the dream? Had Bill turned into some kind of beast? 3 months later, the TV was showing a rerun of Lon Chaney's The Wolfman. Over dinner, Abby said,
"You'll want to watch that, love. You know how much you like it."
Bill threw down his napkin and pushed away from the table.
"Did it ever occur to you that I'm sick of The Wolfman?"
he said as he stormed from the kitchen. Abby sat there in tears, wondering what she'd said to upset her husband so much. Bill, sulking in the living room, also wondered what had upset him so much. Abby was just trying to be friendly. She loved him, cared about him. Then why did he get so upset when she mentioned the Wolfman? Bill went for a walk, trying to calm himself, angry with himself for treating her so badly. And as he walked, he thought of a certain summer day when he'd been playing in the backyard of his house, and when something terrible had happened to him. Something he had taught himself to forget. The first interview with Bill Ramsey. Did you have any inkling that you were going to have one of your seizures when the first one came on?
I've always had a bad temper. I don't get angry very often, but when I do, I tend to block everything out but the anger. People who have seen me this way say they have gotten scared from time to time, especially because it's such a contrast to the way I usually behave. But again, I want to emphasize that I very rarely lose my temper. Very rarely.
Were you angry the first time you found yourself changing personalities and physical shape?
Yes, quite angry.
Had you ever had this particular sensation before?
Well, I suppose that, like a lot of people, I'd always considered myself a little strange sometimes. And once in a while I'd look at my hands and imagine that they were paws, the way an animal's might be. And sometimes I'd see a dog running in a field and I'd wonder what that would feel like. There must be a lot of freedom in that, you know? And I'd wondered what the dog would sense, the smells and the sights, and just the feeling of being an animal without all the human inhibitions we have.
As a boy, did you ever imagine yourself to be a monster of any kind?
Not a monster, but certainly I did imagine myself to be different. I had a lot of good friends, but there was always a part of me that was reserved and a little secretive, a part of myself that I couldn't really show to anybody.
Were you violent as a boy?
Not really. I'd get in a fight now and then, but nothing serious. And usually I wasn't the one to start it anyway. I really didn't like fighting.
So the first time you felt the sensation of changing into an animal, did you feel violent then?
Oh, definitely. And that's what was so frightening. It came on very suddenly, and I had all sorts of dark inclinations, the most urgent one being this need to attack somebody.
You mean literally, physically attack somebody?
Oh, yes, definitely.
When you look back over the years, can you see one very special day in your life?
Oh, certainly. The day when I was playing in the backyard.
You changed then?
Changed completely. My mom said so too, even though she had no idea what had happened. She said that I became a very different boy. That where I'd been happy-go-lucky, I was now withdrawn and edgy about things.
Were you aware of what happened to you that day?
Not exactly. Not specifically, I guess I'm trying to say. Just that something had entered my soul. Something that didn't belong there.
Would you tell about it?
Yes, but I have to be honest. Even after all these years, it upsets me a great deal to talk about it.
A coldness in the soul. Like many imaginative 9-year-olds, Bill Ramsey often liked to play alone. Companions had a way of inhibiting him. With them, he had to play real games. But when he was alone, his mind was free to roam, and he could be anybody from the man in the iron mask to Flash Gordon. There was even music in his head, the way there was in the rousing movies at the Saturday matinee. And there were always pretty damsels he was rescuing. Damsels who rewarded him with a tender kiss and a rose, symbolic of their esteem for him. Bill Ramsey often played alone in his backyard. While it wasn't large, it was grassy, and the sun filled it in the afternoon. Sometimes his mother would have wash hanging on the lines that ran the length of the yard, and the air would be pleasantly filled with the fresh aroma of clean sheets. Bill often played out there for long hours, coming in only when his mother called him for supper. In 1952, Bill Ramsey was in school and had made many friends, but he still liked playing alone in the backyard, at least sometimes. On this particular day, a sunny Saturday, as he recalls, he had come home from the movies and looked forward to 2 hours of light before night came. He helped his mother with a few chores and then ran outside, eager to play fighter pilot. The matinee that afternoon had run 2 films about Royal Air Force adventures in World War II, and in his mind, Bill was now ensconced in a fighter plane, diving to take out a German bomber destined to set London aflame. Bill was rested from a good night's sleep, had a 2-full stomach from movie theater popcorn, and felt restless, with an abundance of energy. He played for an hour, before he turned and felt a coldness come over him like an invisible ocean wave. To this day, Bill recalls the sensation exactly.
Have you ever walked into a meat locker right after you've been outside on a hot day? That's what this was like. I was playing and my body temperature was normal, and then, well, I'd say it felt as if my body temperature dropped a good 20 degrees. Sweat froze on me, and my whole body started shaking. It was as if I'd opened this door and stepped inside to another dimension or something. And there was this odor, very foul. A few years earlier, a sewer on our street had backed up. I'd never smelled anything as foul as the gases that escaped. And that's what this smell was like that afternoon. I was afraid I was going to vomit.
Bill stood in the backyard for a long time, trying to make sense of what had happened to him. He no longer wanted to play. He felt that he had changed in some subtle yet profound way. Something terrible had just happened to him, but he had no idea what. Eventually, the chill left his body and the smell drifted away. He was again a seemingly normal 9-year-old boy, standing in the center of his backyard, his curly hair tousled, his body temperature warm again. He started playing once more, but somehow it wasn't the same. Now, when he closed his eyes and imagined himself a fighter pilot, with the music swelling in the background and a variety of sound effects playing in his ears, it seemed silly, something a child would do. And curiously, Bill no longer felt like a child. Light faded. Up and down the block you could hear mothers calling their children in. Fathers sat in front of their TV sets, sipping cold glasses of beer. Children began straggling in, being put through the torture of washing up with soap and water, slicking down their hair and marching in a somewhat orderly fashion to the dinner table. In most houses, that is. But at one house, not all the children were inside as yet. At one house, one lone 9-year-old still stood in the backyard, shadowy in the growing gloom of night. Something had happened to Bill, but he didn't know what, and it frightened him. He was different now. He had long ago ceased his playing. He stood staring up at the first of the night stars, feeling the coldness starting to shudder through him again. He walked slowly over to the fence to look down the narrow alley. If he followed the alley far enough, it would lead him to the sea. He thought now of stealing aboard a boat, the way young Jim Hawkins had in Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island, and sailing somewhere far away where people wouldn't know the truth about him, about the strange coldness inside him now, about the curious, growing rage that seemed to overtake him like a blinding seizure. Images of himself as a wolf began flashing through his mind. He thought about Larry Talbot as Lon Chaney played him in The Wolfman, and how Talbot pleaded with the gods not to turn him into a wolf again. Through the fog of his thoughts and fears, he heard his mother's voice calling him in. Ordinarily, this would have been a comforting thought, a reassurance that the world was a safe, knowable place filled with parents who loved and cared about him and wanted to protect him. But tonight, he heard his mother's voice differently. Somehow it irritated him. Didn't she know the truth about him? Didn't she know that he was quite capable of taking care of himself? He turned, the rage starting to course through him now, and in so doing caught the toe of his shoe against the fence post. He tripped and fell to the ground. By the time he'd regained his feet, his anger was blinding him, and he heard the low, chilling rumble of a frenzied beast and knew that, somehow, it was himself he was hearing. He turned to the fence post, which had been dug and planted deep into the ground, and tore it from its moorings so violently that dirt and grass were flung all the way up on the back porch. Seeing this, his horrified mother called to his father, and they both came running out of the house. But Bill was too far gone in his rage to stop. 3 men would have had a hard time getting the fence post from the ground, yet Bill had done it simply and brutally. And now he stood swinging the post over his head as if it were nothing more than a baseball bat. The wire fencing attached to the post was still nailed to the wood. When his parents drew close and shouted for him to put the post down, Bill hurled it to the ground. But then he fell to his knees and began ripping into the wire fencing with his hands. He pulled the fencing to his teeth and began tearing it apart with them. His father, terrified by now, tried to pull his son to his feet, but was having a difficult time. The boy's strength was incredible and frightening. His mother began sobbing. Finally, hearing the grief he was causing her, Bill relented and forced himself to get back into control. He threw the fence back to the ground. His hands and mouth were bloody from where the wire had torn it. In the darkness, all he could hear was his mother's sobbing and his father's confused cursing. And all Bill himself could feel was the peculiar coldness. A coldness at his very center. A coldness that marked him as different from other human beings. He turned to them then, thinking he was about to say something reassuring, but he was once again seized with the rage. He saw another image of himself as a wolf. Another growl started up from his belly and filled his chest and burst out of his mouth. His mother and father turned and ran back to the house. On the back porch, his mother tripped. His father bent to pick her up, and when he did so, he looked back at his son and thought he saw a wolf. And then his parents rushed inside and bolted the door, leaving Bill in the twilit backyard. Eventually, the roaring quieted, and Bill began to feel the rage leave his body. Some of the coldness left, too, finally. But as he made his way across the backyard up to the porch, he realized that something terrible had happened here today. Something that could never be undone. He raised his small hand and started knocking on the back door. His mother and father looked at each other, unsure if they should let him in. What a strange feeling, to be afraid of your own little boy. But neither could withstand the loneliness they felt. And so they opened the door. He came running into their arms, the way a much younger child might. All three of them cried there in the doorway. Later, as his mother served them dinner, she found herself noticing that Bill had changed in some way, physically. It was a subtle change, one she couldn't really identify, but he had changed in some way of which only a mother would be aware. They said nothing more of the incident in the yard. Both his parents wanted to believe that it had just been some freakish incident and should be utterly forgotten. And so it was. For a few years, anyway. Interview with Bill Ramsey. You said in a different interview that you were able to forget what happened that day when you were 9 years old. How was that possible?
I knew I needed to forget it.
Why?
Because I felt that if I thought about it very often, it might happen to me again.
The anger?
Yes, the anger and the state of mind. I'd never experienced anything like that before. It was as if I became a different person. That's what was so terrifying. It was almost like an out-of-body experience, when you watch your body as if it belongs to another person. That day in my backyard, I saw myself tear that fence post from the ground. I saw myself rip the wire fencing apart in my teeth. I saw myself turn to my parents as if I were some kind of beast.
Did your parents ever mention it again?
Not really. They didn't want to remember it any more than I did. Seeing a son of yours act like that, well, it's not very pleasant.
So for a long time you forgot it?
Repressed it, would be a better word. The way you repress a secret sin. Something you did that you're literally afraid to recall. Children have a lot of secret sexual sins. Experiments with other children and things of that sort. And this was like those, except that it wasn't based simply on guilt. This was something that was genuinely frightening to think about.
Did you begin to look at yourself differently?
Of course I did. I couldn't put any words to it. I certainly didn't think of myself in any melodramatic way as a wolf man or anything like that. But certainly I now felt different from other children. In fact, that was one of my great fears.
Attacking other children?
Absolutely. I was afraid that one of my friends would do or say something that would set me off, and that I would react the way I had that day in the backyard. Only this time I wouldn't be throwing about a fence post. I'd be throwing about a human being.
You said in another interview that you'd always felt a little different from other children. Not a monster, but different.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's true. This was when I was very small. 4 or 5 or 6, but that afternoon when I was 9, well, that confirmed that I was different, didn't it?
Couldn't you have experienced a simple outburst of temper and frightened yourself?
Do you think a normal 9-year-old boy can tear a fence post from the ground or eat wire fencing?
But you did manage to go on with your life.
Of course. Every once in a while, something would stir my memories and I'd get a little afraid. But I had a pretty typical teenage life in Southend-on-Sea.
And there were no more seizures?
I don't think so.
You're not sure?
Well, if you're asking me, did I lose my temper? Sure, of course I did. If you're asking me, did I get into an occasional fight? Again, the answer is, of course I did. But if you're asking me if I suffered another seizure, no, I don't think so. I think my outbursts were well within the normal range of outbursts.
Did you still consider yourself something of a freak?
A little bit, I suppose. I wanted everybody to like me and to think that I was the most ordinary guy of all. That's why I was so afraid of having a seizure. Behaving this way in front of your parents is one thing, but behaving this way in front of other people is quite something else, you know? They wouldn't be as understanding or forgiving as my parents. If I ever put on a display like the one in my backyard, I'd be marked for life socially. And I knew it.
So you managed to get through the teen years pretty well?
Pretty uneventful, really. Pretty uneventful.
By day he walks among other humans, lives among them, and few, if any, suspect his terrible secret. It is only by night, those autumn nights when the moon is full and the wolf's bane blooms, that the change overtakes him, that the fur begins to grow on his body and his teeth become long and sharp, that his hands and feet alter shape, the fingers and toes turn into pads and gleaming claws, and he drops down onto all fours, that the mind and soul of a man are transmogrified into those of a ravening wolf. Only then that he leaves the world of Homo sapiens to run free in the moonlight and the shadows, to hunt the unsuspecting and the unwary, who will become his prey. Hunger is what possesses him on those nights. The overpowering, all-consuming lust for human flesh, human blood. The soft throat, the living organs are his goal and his fare. He knows nothing else. And when the night is done, when he is killed and ravaged and fed, he returns, sated, to his human lair to await the change that will again make him a man. It comes at the first light of dawn, that second change, and after it is complete and his intellect is restored, he remembers the hunt, the kill, the blood. He remembers all of this, and perhaps the memory fills him with pain and torment. Bill Pronzini, The Werewolf. A Terrifying Incident. Bill Ramsey went on with his life. As has been mentioned, he married, began raising a family, and worked as a carpenter. The building trade, however, was not always reliable, so Bill Ramsey was sometimes forced to take other kinds of work to feed his family. An industrious and exemplary worker, Bill had enough friends and business contacts to keep busy. In the early 80s, the recession that struck America also struck Britain. Unemployment lines wound around the block, and normally cheery, if insincere, politicians sent forth a message of doom and gloom. Bill was one of many to suffer from these economic setbacks, and, for the first time since marrying Abby, he found himself concerned about his job prospects. Even with all his friends and business contacts, times were very, very tough. One day he ran into a friend named Matthew Jennings, who owned an office cleaning company. Jennings said that he was overloaded with work. Bill started thinking about going into business for himself. If Matthew was overloaded, Bill could buy some cleaning equipment and take on the jobs Matthew couldn't handle, giving Matthew a small percentage of the gross in return. Bill had always had a good relationship with his father-in-law, who was a member of the Coast Guard, patrolling the coastline to make sure that everything was all right. Bill's father-in-law felt that the cleaning business sounded good. Even in times of economic setbacks, offices needed cleaning. and so he lent Bill the necessary money. In early autumn, Bill went to work cleaning and refurbishing offices. Many of the jobs involved clearing out, cleaning, and then repainting the offices. Bill had such a job in Billericay, a small rural town 10 miles from Southend. He liked the atmosphere of Billericay, its open fields silver with frost in the evening, the sunlight on the buildings of the main street during the day. Some of the buildings were several hundred years old. The streets seemed to ring with the echoes of horses and fancy carriages, where ladies and lords once amused themselves with leisurely rides. Bill worked the job alone for the first few days. All that was required was cleaning, and while that was certainly a back-breaking chore, he felt he could keep all the money for himself. His family needed it. When painting was required, Bill hired 2 friends. Painting had to be done with care. One man in a hurry tended to get sloppy. Bill always took the utmost pride in his work. October came, with its nights of full harvest moons and foggy moors. For no reason he could understand, Bill found himself waking in the middle of the night and going to the window to look out. He stared for long periods at the moon. It was almost as if the moon held a secret for him, a secret he was trying to understand by staring. Sometimes a cold chill passed through his body as he stood there. He recalled, reluctantly, the day he'd ripped the fence post from his parents' backyard, and the strange coldness he'd felt then. Was this a similar coldness? Images of wolves flashed across his mind as he stared at the round, silver moon. He looked back through the shadows where his wife Abby lay sleeping in bed. He felt guilty and ashamed of himself for standing at the window and thinking such thoughts about himself. He was a respectable family man. He should not inflict his insane notions on the family he loved so much. Yet he felt something, some need, growing within him as he stood at the window on his nightly vigil. But what was it? For now, anyway, it did not seem to be rage. For now, anyway, he did not feel possessed of superhuman strength. For now, anyway, he did not want to lash out at anybody and inflict pain. He told himself, finally, that he had been under great stress because of the economy and was simply suffering from delusions. He was not a wolf, but a man. He was not a killer, but a peaceful and God-loving Christian. He was not a dreaded creature of the shadows, but a respectable father whose children adored him. Tired, that was all. Get some sleep. Feel better. And so he trudged back to bed and slid beneath the covers against the reassuring warmth of his wife. What a good woman she was. He closed his eyes and rolled over. Too little sleep, too much imagination. After he rested, he would feel better. Much better. He was sure of it. During the early part of the fall, Bill tried to convince himself that nothing serious was troubling him, and went about his appointed tasks with his usual ready smile for everyone. If he was troubled, nobody else was aware. Bill wasn't the sort of man to burden others with his problems. One evening, having gone out for some late-night groceries his wife needed, Bill drove past a church. It was a familiar church, one he passed often. But tonight, silhouetted against the full moon, as clouds raced across the sky, the spire seemed majestic. Its effect on Bill was profound. He couldn't articulate it, but he had the sense that in some way God was about to take a personal interest in his life. But he wondered if he wasn't being as foolish as he'd been about his dreams of being a wolf. Tired, that was all. Get the groceries and get back home and watch some TV, and then turn in early. Still, throughout the coming days, he kept with him that image of a church spire, silhouetted against a full autumn moon. For some reason, the image comforted him. Work progressed nicely. Bill's friends Jeremy Wright and Scott Bursnell proved to be very reliable workers. Sometimes after work, the 3 men would get together for beers at a nearby public house. While their wives would probably have preferred that they come straight home, the men had a good, harmless time in the public house, and they always made sure that one of them was sober so he could drive. One particular Sunday was especially tough on the men. They'd worked with little time off since Friday evening. They were now exhausted. On the way home, one of them suggested they stop for a few beers.
On Sunday?
Why not? We deserve it, don't we?
Nobody could argue with that. not the way these men had been working non-stop. So they pulled into the parking lot of the public house and went inside. On the way in, Bill felt a chill work its way down his body. He shuddered. He assumed that this was simply because the temperature had dropped several degrees in the past few hours. For the first time that season, he could smell winter coming on the night wind. He went in and had a few beers, and forgot all about the cold spasm that had worked through him earlier. That night, Bill drank with unaccustomed fervor. Usually he paced himself so he wouldn't get terribly drunk. The older he got, the more difficult hangovers were to handle. He marveled now at how he'd been able to stay out and drink till all hours when he was a lad. He no longer had the constitution for it. The public house was a respectable place for working men. In addition to the companionship, there was always a game of darts going on and occasional friendly card games. No serious gambling. The three men stayed a few hours and then set off. Bill stopped in the men's room before leaving. When he was washing his hands, he glanced up at the mirror. He was stunned. There in the glass was the image of a wolf. And then he laughed out loud. He really was tired. The image had lasted only a moment, and then became the more familiar visage of Bill Ramsey. He was getting bad. He was hallucinating. The way the lads of his generation had always hallucinated when they were on LSD, a substance Bill had always been terribly afraid of and had left completely alone. He splashed water in his face, laughed again at his own foolishness, and walked out to the parking lot. At night, the English countryside is particularly picturesque. Here one can see the architecture of several centuries, and observe the small villages immortalized by William Wordsworth and Agatha Christie. Scott Bursnell drove through just such a section of countryside on the way home. He was a good driver, and quite sober. In the back were Bill and Jeremy. The front seat was filled with painting equipment. Bill and Jeremy had obviously had a great deal more to drink than had Scott. They had been driving half an hour when Bill felt the strange urge begin to work its way irresistibly into his conscious mind. He later described it this way.
"Have you ever had a thought so horrible you tried to put it out of your mind immediately?"